Welcome to the Kona Edge, where you'll discover what the best triathletes in the world do to give them the edge.
You're listening to the Kona Edge. I'm Brad Brown, coming to you from an absolutely gorgeous Cape Town in South Africa. Thank you so much for downloading and listening to this podcast. I'm in a very, very cool mood. I must tell you, I had one of the coolest experiences end of last week. And I love hearing from people just like you, triathletes just like you from around the globe who listen to the Kona Edge. And I recently heard back from someone who, funnily enough, we've spoken to on the podcast before. And they said to me, we're coming to South Africa on holiday. He was bringing his family on vacation. And we had organized to catch up for a quick coffee on Friday afternoon. And so what a great pleasure it was to meet Roger Hastie in person. We've chatted on Skype, and I'll put the links to his episodes here on the Kona Edge in the show notes to this one. But got to meet Roger and his wife and daughter as well, which was fantastic. And yeah, I want to extend the invitation to you. If you ever make it out to Cape Town in South Africa, please do look me up. I'd love to catch up. I absolutely loved it. So I'd love to catch up with you or anyone who comes all this way to Cape Town. It's a long way to come, I know. But it's a magnificent place to come on holiday or vacation, but also to get some training in. I know Roger hired himself a bike while he was out here. Got a couple of really nice rides and a couple of good runs in as well. So I'd love to hear from you. My email address is brad@thekonaedge.com. That's how you can touch base. But yeah, it was fantastic. So Roger, I know you're listening. Thank you so much for touching base. And thanks for the coffee, mate. Much appreciated. Let's get into today's episode. And I'm really excited to share this story with you, because I think it's pretty cool. Someone who's extremely busy, got a pretty high profile job, a stressful job, and manages to juggle that, plus a wife and a pretty successful Ironman career as well. We head to London to catch up with Martin Muldoon. Martin, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Brad. Good chatting to you.
Martin, we're smack bang in the middle of the Olympics, and I think worldwide people have fallen in love with the two Irish rowers. They're sort of putting Ireland on the map, aren't they?
They are indeed, yeah. They're making a big impact for just two, and I think it's Ireland's only medal at the minute, but what a way to do it. You know, they were strong lads, but you know, apart from being great athletes, they're obviously big characters as well, so I think everybody in the world is having a good time watching these guys.
And you've got to promise, next time you make it onto a podium, you have to wear your podium pants.
Absolutely. I need to get myself a good pair. Maybe from the underpants run in Hawaii, I'll take them up to the stage. I've never seen anybody do that, so there's got to be a first.
I love it. Martin, let's talk about your journey into triathlon and where it all started for you. How did you get roped into and sucked into the sport? Because it is addictive, and once you're in, you can never get out.
You're right there. It's very addictive sport. My journey was kind of, and I've met a lot of people with similar story that came from some kind of a hardship. I mean, some people went into the sport just because they're very clean living, healthy, outdoor people. And I've, the times in the past, I have been like that. But the reason I got into triathlon specifically was because I was just going through a tough period. A company I worked for at the time, this is going back about probably 12 years now, which is a bit scary to think of how long it's been. I couldn't swim, but I was a runner when I was a kid at sort of national standard or at least provincial standard. And so I had that background. I knew how to run, and I wouldn't have taken too much training for me to get back into running. But I was working for a company that started to fold up, and everybody lost their jobs. At the same time, I was going through a really bad breakup after like a 9-10 year relationship. So I put on all this weight, and I was carrying probably, considering I raced at about 70 kilos now, I was sitting, I think, about 90 kilograms or close to 90 kilograms. So I had to lose a bit of weight, and I just started running. So running got me back into that sort of endurance mindset, and I started losing weight. And within 6 months, I was running, you know, 5Ks in like 15, 16 minutes. And then I met a few duathlete guys. I went to this local little duathlon just north of London, and from there met a few triathletes. So it sort of went from that. It took me a while to get into the water. I was afraid of water. I couldn't swim. Even at 30, I couldn't swim. You know, I couldn't put my head under the water. So I had to learn from scratch. And that those first couple of years was pretty technically difficult, and I had to overcome a lot of mental issues with getting comfortable breathing underwater, and especially racing and among beside other people when I was really unorthodox and uncomfortable doing that. So that was hard those first couple of years, but certainly, you get that nice feeling when you come over the line. It doesn't matter what kind of race it is, especially if you're finishing with a run, which was always my strong point. I just got addicted to that feeling of getting over the line and being out there and doing it. So, so it came from hardship, really. And I, like I said, I've the longer I've been in the sport, the more and more people I realize it have come from some kind of pain or some kind of a challenge that they've had to overcome. And then, they take to it from that. And then you get addicted. And from there, it's not that, it's something else. It's just you just enjoy doing the sport and you want to be fit and healthy. So it's continued a bit in a bit more of a positive way, but it started out in a very negative way. So, but at least it got me into the sport, and that's the main thing.
Yeah, and it's a great environment and community to be around as well. Tell me a little bit about your childhood. You mentioned running competitively at a national provincial sort of level. You were obviously very competitive as a kid. Did it come easy to you, or was it hard work?
It was easy in that from when I was no age, I can't even remember I was really young when I started playing Gaelic football. So where I'm from, the two main sports would be Gaelic football and hurling, Gaelic football is a bit similar to Aussie rules if you've never seen it. Hurling is a little bit like a mix between hockey and, I don't know, well, it's a bit like hockey, but the sticks are in the air and it's a little bit more crazy and high speed. But my village played Gaelic football, so the running was part of that. And then the fitter you were, the longer you could play fast for, and it helped your game. I wasn't technically good at the game, but I was good with the running and the jumping part. But certainly when I was 12, 13, going on 14, I was in a running club, and me and another fella, we were probably, 1-2 in at least Ulster, which is the northern province in Ireland. And we'd go and race other parts of Ireland. We usually did pretty well up in the top five around Ireland. So at 13, I was probably running, faster times over 800 and 1500 than I've ever done since, So that was, we were certainly, I pretty much gave it up seriously by 14 or 15. I started cycling. But at that age, if you're pushing out those times as a kid, then that's the sort of young ones that would go on and do, become international, etc. But I had, time I was 16, 17, studying in college and stuff, you discover alcohol, women, that sort of thing. So I was one of the ones that went by the wayside. But thankfully, it stayed with me in the background. And, like I say, you can tap into it every 6 months, get back into running, lose a bit of weight, and you're probably running faster than most people. So it was a good background to have, that's for sure.
Having achieved what you've achieved now and looking back, do you kind of regret that you didn't pursue it more seriously?
Definitely. I mean, I think in the early days I regretted when I was struggling to get fit and people were running away from me in races in the early triathlons and duathlons. But that was probably mostly due to the fact that I couldn't swim or bike properly. But I think if I was asked, would I rather have done it the way I've done it, as in been really good at it and done nothing and come back to it, or been really good for 10 years and now be out of shape, I'd much rather do it how I've done it. And that now I'm 42 and I'm very interested in a great sport. It keeps me fitter and more healthy than normal people my age. There's a lot of people in my life, they're really good people, like family, people I work with, people I meet just outside the sport at my age. And there's a significant difference when I see health-wise, people complain about certain health issues that I just don't have because I spend 20 to 25 hours a week doing exercise, and most people, most normal people don't really do anything at all. So, yeah, I think I'd rather have missed out a few years, early days, and perhaps missed out in some glory of being a good runner when I was, say, 18 or 20. But, I'm 42 and I'm fit, so I guess it could be a lot worse.
It's interesting too, because it's very seldom that you get somebody that is competitive at that sort of level from a youngster, like a teenager, all the way through to their 40s. It's just, burnout is such a real thing, and sometimes having a break like that actually is good for you.
Yeah, definitely. And I think apart from the physical side, I think the mental side of burnout is something that people underestimate, and people new to the sport don't realize that it exists, because it takes a few years for someone to get burned out properly. I've seen me being really aggressive, not aggressive, but being really forward with my coach, trying to push him and trying to get him to give me really aggressive training plans, you know, because I'm all motivated in the new year. And he's like, just calm down. We'll do it in a modular structure and do it in a way that we know you can handle. He's a very scientific coach. There's a guy called Alan Cousins from, he's actually Aussie, but he's based in Boulder. And he's a proper, you know, self-confessed science geek. So he's big into the numbers, but he finds a huge amount of correlation, and he can prove it with the math that if you go in too aggressive, there's physical reasons why, you know, scientific reasons why you break. You know, some people can handle a huge amount of volume without getting tired, without getting sick, but I'm not one of them. And so if I was following the same plan as my buddy, who's also coached by Alan, he can train 30 hours a week and he just never gets tired, never gets sick. If I did that, I'll just be, you know, I'd be out of action. I probably would have left the sport a couple of years ago. So having a smart coach who can tell you to pull back, de-stress, keep your energy levels good, you know, especially when you're mixing it with the job, you need to be really smart about that. And each athlete is different. So I think, avoiding burnout is different for everybody. And I think it's a very important thing to look into. So it's something I'll talk about a little briefly later at HRV, yeah. Which is something that
I find it interesting you say he's a smart coach, but it takes a smart athlete to be able to listen to a smart coach.
Yeah. Or at least, you know, even if you're not too smart about it, if you listen, that's a very good point, because if you have someone who's obviously into the numbers and monitors what you do and gives you feedback based on it, whether that be you can push a little more or, you know, the thing that you don't hear so much of is to ease back. There's probably not enough coaches out there that watch their athletes closely and tell them that they're dangerously close to burnout or an injury or just getting sick, because we all know, I mean, it's something you hear all the time about consistency being really important. And if you're getting sick once a month or once every 2 months, you lose, you know, you can just watch the graphs on Training Peaks just drop out every time you get sick. So you're kind of working really hard for 6 weeks. You lose 10 days for sickness. You're kind of back to where you were 2 months ago. So avoiding sickness is actually a very good strategy to slowly getting fitter. And so I think it's a very important thing to monitor.
Talk to me about the decision. Well, obviously you move from running into duathlon and then deciding to do your first triathlon. I mean, and having to learn to swim, that's huge. The decision, yeah, to do your first one, you had obviously done some swim training, or did you jump in feet first and go, you know what, let's put some pressure on myself to learn to swim?
Yeah, well, you know what, I could swim and keep my head above the water, but it's something you couldn't do in a race. I could do the breaststroke, but I'm a very competitive person, and maybe because I did those sports when I was very young, I just have that thing where I want to win, I want to do well. I was in a team of Gaelic footballers that won a lot of stuff, and I think that mentality was still there. And the fact that I couldn't swim was difficult for me because I was getting out of the water 5-10 minutes behind other people, and so it was in my interest as a competitive person to try and improve my swimming. So it was really back to start, like really starting from scratch. I went to lessons with these old ladies and these young kids that literally couldn't swim at all, and I just sort of down to earth went back to scratch and tried to learn right from the start again, and it did me good because I learned the proper techniques. I mean, some of my swim clubs say I still can't swim, but certainly 10 times better than I used to be. And since then, I've done a lot of work on it. So it's a lot more respectable than it used to be, but still questionable, I would say.
I love that. Martin, the decision to do the long ones. I mean, there's lots, particularly in the UK, there's so many triathlons and not just the long stuff. I mean, there's sprints, there's Olympic distance. What pulled you towards the longer stuff?
Well, I think, looking at a far-reaching goal in the distance, so I didn't rush into it. I probably did my first triathlon when I was about 30, and I gave myself a five-year plan because I'd read about Ironman. You know, I'd heard about it, and I'd seen clips of it on TV, and I just thought it was some crazy sport that other people do. But whenever I got to do it, I finally got to do a sprint. Even though the swim scared the life out of me, I went off too hard. I thought I was going to drown in the water, somebody swam over the top of me. And, you know, I was already claustrophobic and nervous in the water. So to consider doing like 10 times that distance, in the water was really frightening. But I thought if I give myself time, I thought by the time I'm 35, I'm going to do one of those Ironman. So I sort of just built this long, slow plan towards doing it. And that's exactly what I did. So the time I was 35, I finally did an Ironman, but I did it properly in that, you know, I built a plan, I got a good coach, and Yeah, maybe my first Ironman itself didn't quite go as planned, but that was probably because I didn't follow the plan on the day. But I certainly think going long is a big challenge for anybody coming into the sport. You're always going to have at least one weakness that you have to work on, and I think it's good to give it time. And I guess you're less likely to burn out as well if you do it slowly, go slowly towards your goal.
Tell me about that first one. I love hearing stories of where things don't go according to plan. I think it gives the rest of us hope. What went wrong in your first one, and how did things go?
Yeah, so it was in Germany, and it's a great one to do for anybody, you know, whether you're experienced or not. The Germans are big into Ironman. They're very, very organized. Everything's done perfectly. You know, the whole efficiency of the organization is done so well. It's really impressive, but I had this brilliant plan. I went in, I was properly trained, I was fit. I was following a guy from, this guy called Gordon Byrne, who's a colleague of my coach, Alan. They work for Endurance Corner, and they're very disciplined on you know, how they're very strategic in how they go in towards these races. It's not just go in and hit it hard. It's very thought out process. So I had this brilliant plan with Gordo. This was before I met Alan, and the plan itself was, you know, it's similar to a plan I would follow now. It's all very structured. It's about holding back and trying to be strong at the end and looking after nutrition and all that sort of stuff, you know, and what to do, probably taper in, all that type of thing. However, on race day, decent swim, maybe went a little bit too fast. On the bike, I held back, so I was fairly civilized on the bike, but maybe in both of those disciplines, I was just slightly, you know how Ironman is, if you go just slightly over your threshold, it's asking for trouble. And sure enough, that 1 or 2% that I went over just from the excitement of race day and maybe I got caught racing a few times on the run. So I'm a runner, I'm confident on the run. So the first 10K in like 42 minutes and I'm feeling fantastic, probably sitting on close to world record pace on the run, not realizing what was about to come. And this guy came past me, an Irish fella that I recognized from he was quite well known back home in the triathlon circles. So I think he'd been to Kona already, and a lot of respect for this guy. But it felt like an easy pace. We're sitting running about 4 minutes per K, and it was only easy because, you know, that was only 10K in. But he went on to qualify for Kona, and 15K in, I completely exploded. I fell apart. I had to stop and walk through every aid station. I ran out of energy. Muscles were fatigued. I was dehydrated. Ran out of salt, so it was cramping. And halfway through the run, 20K, I'm still 20K to go. And I seriously thought I was going to have to just pack it in because I didn't think I could finish. But somehow I got jogging again and sort of patched it together and made it over the finish line. But very, very disappointed that I hadn't followed my plan. You know, I actually followed the plan pretty close up until the run, and then I just got caught racing with somebody. So, I learned a lot from that race. And every Ironman I did since that, I qualified for Kona, so I had a plan. I followed it, but that day I had a good plan. I just didn't quite follow it, and it showed me the importance of not getting excited, not getting carried away. No matter how good you feel in certain points of the race, that you still have to stick to the plan, because it's not about how you feel then; it's about how you feel 2 hours later or 4 hours later. So it's a very long day. It's a very strategic type distance.
Are you grateful you learned that lesson early on in your Ironman career?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I still do races where I struggle. It's probably now more to do with, if I have problems in the build with fitness and things like that. But I learned, it was such a painful lesson. It was definitely the worst blow up I had. And when you go through that much pain, it sort of burns something into your brain that you never forget. And I think that actually helped me long term to not make the same mistakes again. So I think doing that in my first Ironman was, you know, it was a bit of a painful lesson, but it was a good one.
Did you say to yourself afterwards, you never want to do that again?
Yeah, I went through definitely. I actually went through a bit of, you know, I got a bit depressed about it, partly because that part of that plan was Kona as well. You know, the long term goal for me was Kona, and being as ambitious and competitive as I am, Kona was part of that plan. And the fact that I missed it by, you know, Germany's very competitive, so I was only probably 20 minutes off the Kona qualifiers, but 20 minutes, as we all know, is quite a big chunk of time in an Ironman. So if you're competitive, so I found that very frustrating. I was annoyed at myself for blowing up, for not following the plan. And of course, you know, as time goes on and you watch all these other guys going to Kona and you're sitting at home planning next year, I was a bit down about it. So yeah, I mean, it was difficult, but like you said earlier, I learned a lot from it, and I didn't make that mistake again. I made some other mistakes, but.
You mentioned every Ironman since then. You've qualified. Kona's become quite a big part of what you do and sort of what drives you. That second one. How long after the first one did you go back and give it another bash?
So I with the standard sort of layout of Ironmans in Europe, unless you're going to attack more than one a year, which I didn't. I'd never really ambition to do more than one as a qualifier. So I waited a full about a year. So I did Switzerland the following year, and I mean I was nervous. I didn't, probably because of Germany, I lost some confidence, and I was very ambitious, but I wasn't confident. And so going into that race, I had no idea what was going to happen. I obviously hoping for a Kona slot, and a good friend of mine, Owen, and another Irish lad, we were very strong. You know, me and him have always been sort of neck on neck. We came through the ranks together. He had just qualified, and he's a very down-to-earth, straight-talking kind of lad. There's no big talk. There's no fancy strategies. It's just, you know, he's got a very structured method of getting in to do it. He does all the work. So he had just qualified, and I had a chat with him, and I was having a bit of a crisis. I just didn't believe in myself. And he sort of, gave me a bit of a slap. And I come out of that conversation feeling a lot more confident. And sure enough, I went into Switzerland. I had a good race, didn't do anything exciting. I just did, you know, through each discipline in a kind of a regulated way. And I come out, thankfully, having a strong run. You know, I think it was close to 3 hours, which for me is not particularly fast. But I realized that in Ironman, you know, if you have that strength at the back of the race and you haven't blown up your legs on the bike, then that's going to pull you down into the lower rankings of the of your age group, which it did that day, and it got me the slot. So, it was for me, it was a big milestone, a big achievement. So I was just delighted after that.
Talk to me about surrounding yourself with people who have done what you're trying to achieve. I mean, that's a great example of finding someone who's got the experience that you can sort of pick their brain. Is that a huge part of what you do as well, Mark?
Yeah, it is. Certainly it was then. I mean, these days I think as you become very specific and you have a very scientific coach who gives you very specific sets. I don't train as much these days with other people. The two or three guys that I do train with are all sort of mostly Kona qualifiers. I have there's a lad I train with sometimes on the bike who's a big biker, much stronger than me. So it's good to have people like that around you as well, but he doesn't really do Ironmans. Apart from that, yeah, anybody I train with, they tend to be Kona qualifiers or aiming for Kona type of thing. So, but back then, yeah, it was very important to me. I mean, Owen had done it. I'd seen him come from a background of getting into Ironman 12, 13, or maybe 11ers type guy. But then when I met him, he was just breaking into that sub 10. And now he's regularly, you know, around about 9ers. He's broken 9ers as well. So I came up, I sort of met Owen just as he was getting really strong. So I think it is important. Over here in London, the club I was in, there was three or four people of a similar standard. There was a girl in the club who had been to Kona, and you know, I just admired these people. To me, it was like this dream, and you see it in TV, and to meet somebody who'd actually been there, it was a big thing for me. So I was just waiting on every word they said, and I listened to all their advice. And you got to respect people that have done it, because you can't fluke your way into qualifying for Kona. It's not an easy thing. Even now, you know, I've done it 7 times in a row, but that doesn't mean that it's been easy. Every year has been completely different, a different race, a different part of the world, different build of it, injuries, of it, sickness. You know, there's always obstacles. I don't know anybody that goes into qualifying for Kona straight through and making it easy, because, you know, if that's the case, they're either extremely talented and a bit lucky, or they're just, you know, making up stories. Because I don't know of anybody that can qualify for Kona easy, and I certainly don't find it easy these days still.
Let's talk about what it takes. I mean, you work, you've got a life outside of triathlon. How do you, I mean, what do you do for a living, first of all? I mean, how do you get that juggle right? I mean, that's a big thing, that time management that age groupers really struggle with.
That's right, and a lot better at it these days. Early days, I really struggled, and I had a few clashes with my boss about 5, 6, 7. You know, back in my early days qualifying, my boss really did. I didn't tell him much about what we did, because, you know, to the outside, someone who doesn't understand sport, you tell somebody you train 20 hours a week, they'll think you're crazy. And I think the problem was that I didn't want him to know that I had that kind of focus on something outside work, because our job is quite intense. I design systems for connecting banks. There's Cisco coding, Cisco engineering, tech work, and I know my whole background is engineering. So what we do now is there's a small amount of big customers like big banks and exchanges. So I do a bit of work for London Stock Exchange and people like that. It's flexible where you can be. So I can work at home some days, and that's good. That helps you skip it at lunchtime for a run if you have to. But when there's pressure on us guys, which sometimes happens, it can be really intense, and it can certainly take your focus away from the Ironman stuff, where you might have to support some job in Asia Pac, which means, of course, that you're working through the night. And I try to avoid stuff like that happening very often, but it does happen, and you can't. You know, it's unfair on your colleagues to expect them to cover you. You have to do your part. It's probably anything from 35 to 55 hours a week. You know, obviously the really bad weeks, like 50, 60 hours, don't happen that often these days. But they do happen, and that makes Ironman training extremely difficult. But I have a wife. You know, we have a life that involves sport and health, but it we don't have children, so that makes a big difference. Whereas my colleagues, they all have children, and that's their life outside work. But for me, yeah, it's Ironman. Me and Sarah do our thing, we go for walks and stuff, but other than that, it's just work. So yeah, there's not much social life involved at the minute.
You talk about having quite an intense job. Do you find that helps sometimes to switch off, that you're not just thinking about triathlon either?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think stress in life in any form, whether it's a personal problem or something to do with work, or the stress that comes from, you know, family or anything at all, going for a run, heading out on the bike, or even, you know, going for a swim or something, I always find that that's it's a de-stressor. And I know there's some scientific reasons for that, to do with endorphins and things like that, but regardless of the reason, I think, yeah, we all agree in the sport that, you know, it's part of why we're addicted. It takes you away from the real world, which is, you know, sometimes it's a great place, but a lot of the time it's not. You know, there's a reason why they pay us for doing these jobs, because quite often they're, you know, it's a bit of a slog, and it can be really stressful and hard work, and it is good to get away from that. So it's great to have the release, the place where you can spend that energy somewhere else and come back feeling better. So I think we're quite lucky in that way.
Coming from an engineering background, you just by chatting to you, I get the feeling that you've approached this thing from a very analytical point of view, and you spoke about the coaches you've used. Talk to me about the decision. Did you from the start have a coach, or did you try and wing things a bit by yourself first and realize, hang on a sec, I need help?
Yeah, I tried myself, and I think anybody who goes out there and runs really hard every day will get fast for about a month, maybe 2 months, and then you plateau. So there's reasons behind that. You know, the old one of the guys in the US, his name's got in my head. There's a lot of methods that the early American coaches used in the 60s and 70s, where you do speed work and then you switch back to long type tempo runs. And then when your efficiency improves, you go back to speed work. So I was probably doing that without realizing I was doing it. I was just doing it because I just wanted to run. There was no real science behind what I was doing, but it wasn't until I started reading articles by Alan, my current coach, or he's actually been my coach for like 6 years now, a very scientific guy, but good at communicating. His articles are written in a way that anybody could understand them. You know, that there is a bit of numbers in there, but majority of the article is trying to make sense of the science, and it's very readable. So I really enjoyed that, and I started trying to follow some of those methods, and I realized then that Alan was actually coaching individuals. So I contacted him after being with two or three different coaches that didn't quite work out for me. Alan was just an immediate hit. I loved his methods of doing things, and the fact that he could explain to you in a very detailed scientific method why he was doing it and what was the point of each session you were doing. So yeah, he was certainly a good man for me, and he has been since. So no looking back.
Talk to me about making sure there's a point to each session, because that's one thing that I find a lot of guys just end up going out to train for the sake of training. They don't actually realize why they're doing what it is they're doing. Even if they are working with a coach, they're doing the session but not really thinking about the session.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the one benefit from that is that, you know, you're out there and you're exercising and you're chatting to people, and it's very good for your health. It's good for your mindset. But if you want to be really competitive and you want to try and peak properly for a specific competition or a certain part of the season, then I think you do need to get a bit scientific. Even if you don't quite follow why you're doing it, you need a coach who does. So then you just listen to what they're telling you. I know a few people like that. And there's no harm in that either. They're too busy working to ask the coach why they're doing a certain session, or they're just non-technical people, and that's all right. Some people have no real interest in why they're doing it, as long as they know the coach is smart. For me, I've always just been sort of had that analytical sort of interest. My head is interested in why we're doing something. Alan, if you do stop to ask, he can tell you in as much detail as you want, and I sort of switch off once it gets to algorithms. But everything up to that point, I found it. You know, I find it interesting. I find it fascinating. But I mean, a lot of the sessions he has me doing are purely for recovery. So he'll write, and we use Training Peaks. So we'll put a little comment in there saying the structure of this here is purely about recovery. He's got me doing like a 1 hour run, but he wants me to walk some of it. He wants me to make sure it's conversational, do a few drills. It's about, you know, probably more sessions than not are about recovery rather than key sessions trying to break you a bit so that you can rebuild stronger. So a lot of it is very technical, but some of them are purely just so that your body recovers, because, you know, especially someone my age, you got to take recovery really seriously or you'll never get faster.
Tell me about your first experience on the Big Island. It's I mean, everyone's first Ironman they'll always remember, but the first experience in Kona is also pretty special.
It is, yeah. It's a bit scary as well. I mean, it's a very glamorous thing. You turn up and it's really intimidating because everybody's tanned up and they're full of muscles and everybody's bouncing along Alihi Drive, and you're there just feeling very sort of like ordinary, and you're a bit frightened. But it certainly, you know, as a triathlete and someone who came through it admiring those people, and then suddenly you're there, you're one of them. And the other thing is I noticed is that the race itself was really difficult. You sort of forget, you're sort of caught up with the whole atmosphere of the 10 days run into it. You're surrounded by your heroes, and, you know, Chrissy Wellington's running past and Craig Alexander's running the other direction, and you're like, you're high-fiving these guys. And then it comes to the Saturday, the second weekend, and it's like, hold on a second, we've got a huge race here, and it's actually a really tough course, and most people fall apart right there. So the race itself was extremely tough. I find it hard, but I think I gave it so much respect. You know, if anything, I probably held back a little bit too much in my first time there. It was the slowest that I went there. But I don't think that's a bad way to do it. I think it's better to go in there and maybe have 5% left at the end rather than going 5 or 10% over and having to walk the last 10K. So, it's a great experience. It's glamorous. It's like the, you know, the sort of Hollywood red carpet version of our sport. I think unless you're ITU and going to the Olympics, if you're an age grouper and you're a long distance person, it's the pinnacle event, and it's a great experience being there. But certainly, yeah, the thing some people forget about is that there's a huge, difficult race right near the end of the trip. So, don't lose sight of that.
What are you most proud of that you've done on the Big Island?
I think anybody ever asks me, I always say 2012, which was my third time there. It wasn't particularly fast. My placing wasn't particularly high, but just the way I structured the race and how I felt during the race, I think it was about 10 minutes off my best there, and I was just inside the top 20. Which is not special. I've been a lot faster and higher placed in that in the past. But that day, I did it in a way that I felt strong at the end of the bike. And coming past the airport in Hawaii, you know, you're still a fair bit to go on the bike, but you're getting very close to the transition, T2. And I felt strong, no cramps, and I felt ready to run, which is very rare in an Ironman, you know, getting off the bike thinking, actually looking forward to the marathon here. And that year, I ran strong, and I placed fairly well. It was probably at that time one of my better performances, and I think that's the one I'm most proud of. It's not, like I said, it's not my fastest, and it's certainly not my highest placing, but just the way I felt so good during the whole race. And when I get over the line, I was tired, but not like falling apart completely. And you know, I was able to recover within a couple of days. You know, at least physically, I was able to walk properly, which is also a rare thing after an Ironman. But yeah, so not a glamorous, proudest moment, but certainly one that I felt good about. You know, for myself, it was a good. I felt it was a good performance.
If you could go back and talk to yourself getting into the sport now, what knowing what you know now, what would you tell yourself back then?
Oh, wow. There's so much I've learned. I would certainly make a change on my early nutrition. I wasn't very smart about that the early days. I didn't read about it. I think I was just being crude and just going in and hitting it hard. It's kind of the way we did as kids playing Gaelic football or running. You just go hard and you can get off that at a young age. But once you hit 30, and certainly when you hit 40, you have to be very, very specific about nutrition. The other thing I would say is having that structured training plan and having a good coach. I didn't meet Alan until I was 35, which was 5 years into the sport. So I think having someone like him early days would have helped me hugely, because, you know, not only would I have responded better to training then because I was younger, but I would have improved a lot quicker, because I had hit a lot of plateaus during the early days because I didn't know what I was doing. I was just going out and training hard every day and wondering why I was always feeling tired and wondering why I wasn't really improving. So I would say, you know, do the reading, get a smart coach if you can. It's worth paying good money for, because, you know, if you think of ways you can waste money in modern life, and most of it is just completely ridiculous. You don't get anything back for it apart from maybe a sore head or a bit of a bigger stomach, you know. If you can pay good money for a decent coach, it's money well spent, I think.
Yep, could not agree more. Martin, thank you so much for your time here on the Cone Edge. I look forward to getting you back on to talk a little bit about the swim, the bike, the run, and nutrition in the weeks to come, but we'll save that for another time. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks, buddy. Good chatting to you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Kona Edge. Don't forget to connect with us on social media. Simply search for the Kona Edge.